And good to be with each and every one of you here, those of you joining us online. I hope that the studies that we do this weekend will be profitable for you. Again, we're going to be looking at some very familiar psalms this morning, Psalm 22 and 23, if you want to be opening your Bibles to Psalm 22. But I hope that we'll look at them in a way that is helpful, both for ourselves and for other people, as we seek to share the treasures that God has given us in the book of Psalms. I was just thinking, being back here brings back a lot of memories, and this October, I think it will have been 10 years since my little moving U-Haul rolled into Biglerville, and I did not know all the things that the Lord had in store when I chose to come here to work with Scott, and just so grateful to God for all that he's done. He is truly faithful. Through all of the ups and downs of all of this, and I'm so thankful for all of y'all. And wherever we go, y'all will always be a part of what we do. My life changed forever because of coming here, and so I thank God, and I thank each of you for the part that you've had in our lives. Very grateful to be with y'all this morning. So we're talking about the Psalms. There are songs for every season of our life, not just the highs, but also the lows. And so this morning we're going to be talking about songs for suffering and refuge. The Psalms help us learn how to suffer as a Christian. It's so important that we learn how to suffer, because the question in this life is not if we will suffer, it is how we will suffer. And the New Testament is full of examples of how we should do that. First Peter is a great book to talk about, make sure you don't suffer in this way, but suffer as a Christian for doing what's right. And there are ways that we need to do that. And the Psalms are a wonderful template for us to look at how righteous people suffer, how they learn to lament. The word lament is not a word that our culture likes very much. We kind of try to force sadness out and drown it out with all sorts of information or entertainment or other things. But the Psalms sit with lament and teach us how to do that, how to mourn, how to grieve while trusting in God. And so the story of the Psalms that we talked about last night takes us really from a place of more lament, and kind of even gets darker as you get through books 1, 2, and then book 3 is the darkest of the books of the Psalms. But then it turns, and books 4 and 5 move more toward a place of praise, until at the end of the book, all is drowned out in praise to God. Hallelujah. Praise Yahweh. Praise Jehovah. And so the story, the flow of the Psalms tell us where we're going with this. That lament is a central part of the Psalms, but it does not have the last word in Psalms. And so we learn to lament, but we also learn to turn that lament into praise. And hopefully our clicker will work here. I think we might be frozen up. It's not a good meeting unless there is at least some technological craziness going on. So we'll see if this continues. Yeah, I think we're completely frozen. So give me just a second here to see if I can get out of this and redo our screen share. Technology is fantastic when it works. We're going to try this again. Oh, that's not what I wanted. Get out of that. No, I don't want to update Zoom right now. I don't. Tell you what. Timing. Okay, we're back here. Can we advance? All right, here we go. We are back. So the idea of lamenting, again, is something that's kind of foreign to our culture. But the Psalms, most of the Psalms, actually a majority of the Psalms, are laments. Sometimes we remember the praise Psalms more. We just sang a beautiful song of praise from Psalm 19, talking about the law of the Lord and praising that law, showing us how valuable it is. But so many of the Psalms are laments. And I'll just say this, when you open up like a modern hymnal, would you say they're majority lament or majority praise? Praise is far, far outweigh the laments. We don't really have a lot of songs that are completely lament, which there aren't many psalms that are completely lament, to be fair about that. Almost all of the psalms that start with lament move to praise by the end of the psalm. But there is great value in having songs that we sing that talk about suffering, that cry out to God from a place of need. Because if all we ever sing in our assemblies are songs of, oh, life's great, life's happy, things are going well, that just doesn't match life. And the Psalms acknowledge that, that life is difficult, life is painful. Anyone who tells you differently is selling you something, right? So we need to learn how to lament. And I think it's valuable, as songs are written and things like that, that it's good to learn how to lament with the people of God and to come together and to weep with those who weep. The Psalms help us and give us equipment to do that. So in a typical lament, it's going to start with a plea for help or a complaint to God. And then sometimes there is a confession of sin. Sometimes there's a claim of innocence. If you go read Psalm 18, one of the more famous David psalms that's also almost in its entirety quoted in 2 Samuel 22. But sometimes the psalmist is saying, Lord, I've sinned and I know it. Please have mercy on me. Psalm 51, Psalm 25, famous hymns of or psalms of repentance. But then, or there's a claim, Lord, I'm innocent. Why is this happening to me? Which you can look at what Job says in the book of Job. There are several other psalms like Psalm 18 that do that. Then there is almost always a statement of trust in God's promises or in God's past faithfulness. We'll see that in just a minute in Psalm 22 in particular. Is that what we need to do when we're suffering is remember. We need to go back and think about other people who've been through suffering, or to think about what God has done for us or others in the past. Gratitude and remembrance are powerful tools when we are hurting, and it gets us out of the moment into the bigger picture of who God is and what's really going on in the bigger story of things. And unfortunately, I think we are frozen up again. This did not happen last night, so I'm not sure what. Oh, well, there it goes. We'll see if. Just need to keep waking it up, maybe. So then, often, at the end of these Psalms of Lament, there is a statement of praise, of honoring God, or there is a vow of faithfulness in return. Because, Lord, you have done this for me, now here is how I will react to you. This is so important, isn't it? As many times we, in our prayers, cry out to God for help and deliverance, and then forget to do what? Go back and thank God that he has answered our prayers and delivered us. And the story of the 10 lepers, 9 were healed, or 10 were healed. How many went back? Only one went back. The Psalms teach us to cry out to God for deliverance and healing. They also teach us to go back and say thank you when God has answered those prayers. But the thing I want us to note about the laments, the Psalms that cry out to God in anguish, in every innocent sufferer, we see the suffering of Jesus, the only truly innocent sufferer that has ever lived. And you go through the Old Testament and you see the people that suffered, even though they were righteous. And again, none of them were perfectly righteous. But the suffering of Abel in the book of Genesis, Abraham, the things that he went through, Joseph, David, of course, so much of the Psalms revolves around the stories in his life and his character. Job, Hezekiah, Daniel, these men who were fighting to do what's right and many times were suffering because they were doing what's right. And in those instances, even though, of course, David and Abraham, these weren't perfect men, but in those circumstances, they were innocent. I mean, David did not do anything to deserve being chased down by Saul, and yet he was suffering. And so he cries out to God to deliver him. But in every one of those people, when they cry out and say, Lord, what's going on? Can you help me in this situation? My enemies pursue me without a cause. We ultimately are forced to think about the ultimately innocent one who suffered for us. Innocent suffering is a challenging thing to deal with in this world. And the Psalms talk about it. And they don't give us always an explanation. And even the psalmists are not always given an explanation. God doesn't come down and say, well, here's why I'm letting you suffer, and here's what I have in mind, and this and that. Job doesn't get an answer to every question that he had. Why do the innocent suffer? We don't always specifically know. But one of the things that the psalms teach us is that we can be grateful that God allowed the truly innocent one to suffer on our behalf. God is able to redeem innocent suffering, even if we do not understand it. God, it is part of the plan of God to save us. And the laments all point us to Jesus. So that's just something to keep in our minds as we think about this. Again, that does not answer every question. I'm not going to pretend to have all the answers. But it's so important that the Psalms point us to Jesus in this way. Psalm 22. We are in book one of the Psalms, a collection of almost entirely Psalms of David. And there's a great variety of psalms in book one. They are majority psalms of lament, even though there are famous praise psalms in this book. And Psalm 22 is one of the most famous laments because it is quoted so frequently in the New Testament. And I want us, as we think about this psalm, to think about it on a couple of different levels. Again, we could spend so much time doing this. It is a psalm of David. The title tells us so. And I want us to think about this psalm from the perspective of David as we read it, because I do believe that this song was originally written about something that David went through, and he uses some figurative, hyperbolic language to describe his suffering. But that ultimately and obviously, this psalm is about Jesus. Jesus takes this psalm on his lips when he is being crucified. And even the enemies of Jesus around the cross are fulfilling the words of this psalm when our Savior suffered for us. One of the interesting things about this psalm is in the outline, if you look at it, it goes back and forth. This is a roller coaster of an emotional psalm. And it begins with a deep lament, but almost immediately moves to some statements of trust in verses 3 through 5. And then it goes back to lament in verses 6 through 8. And then it goes to trust in verses 9 and 10. And then it goes back to lament in verses 11 through 18. And then back to trust in verses 19 through 21. Well, is this a psalm of lament or is it a psalm of trust? Well, yes. It's both. And isn't this the way our lives often go? Is that from day to day and sometimes even from hour to hour, we have times where we're just in a moment of despair and crying out to God and we feel hopeless. And then we kind of get some perspective, we have some time to calm down, maybe we get some food and some sleep, and we're like, okay, it's going to be okay. God's with me, I'm focused on him. But then sometimes we let that slip a little bit, and now we're back to the turmoil, and we're being tossed to and fro on the waves, and we're lamenting, God, where are you? What's going on? And then, okay, we get a little bit of stillness, a little calm, and we trust God. The Psalms just tell this story, and they show us the kinds of things that we go through. The beautiful thing about this psalm, though, is as it's kind of tossed back and forth between lament and trust in the first half, the last half of the psalm is going to be pure praise for God's deliverance. And that's so important to see, is that lament is turned to praise in this psalm and in almost every psalm of lament. So let's dive into this psalm together and see the different parts here. Psalm 22, to the choir master, according to the Doe of the Dawn, probably a musical term, a psalm of David. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. You know, as we study the Bible frequently, it is easy for words like these, because they're quoted so frequently, to kind of become familiar to us. But I want you to try to imagine that you're reading this for the first time. How is David feeling when he writes the opening lines of this psalm? This is a dark, dark place to be. Because not only is he suffering, but how does he feel about God in these opening verses? Where are you, God? Why are you so far from me? I'm crying out to you and you are not answering. It's so important for us to see that the Bible itself teaches us how to kind of wrestle with God. I think it's fascinating that Jacob's name is changed to Israel after he wrestles with God in the book of Genesis. And the Psalms show us, in a sense, how to wrestle with our trust in God when he's not the God that we expected him to be. Which, what kind of God would he be if he always did what we expected? He would be us, right? He would be a God of our own imagination. But he's not. And so we struggle with, why is he letting this happen? Where is he? I'm crying out to him. I'm doing the things he wants me to do. And yet, where is he? And so when you feel like that in your relationship with God, it doesn't make you a bad Christian to feel that way. But what do you do with that feeling? If you feel forsaken by God, if you feel like God is not answering your prayers, there's a psalm for that. And Jesus took this psalm on his lips. But it moves from a place of lament to a place of trust. That is what the Psalms help us to do, because some people feel abandoned by God, and what do? They run in the opposite direction. So again, the question is not, are we going to at some point feel confused by what God is allowing to happen? That's going to happen at some point. The question is, what will we do in those moments? And the Psalms help us with this. And I think it's fascinating that the question of sufferers is right here in verse 1, right? My God, what's the question? Why? Why is this happening? Why have you forsaken me? And there's Jesus on the cross taking the question of sufferers on his lips. My God, why? Now, I'm not going to try to get into like what exactly was happening in Jesus' head when he was uttering those words. Of course, on an intellectual level, Jesus knew exactly why. He knew that he came to suffer and to seek and save the lost and to give his life a ransom for many. He knew exactly why this was happening. And yet, in the humanity of Jesus, I still wonder if there was not some feeling of, really? Why does this have to happen? And he begged in the garden, right? My Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And again, this is a meditation of the ages of God and man in the person of Jesus struggling with the will of the Father. I cannot explain all of that, but this psalm contemplates the wrestlings of Jesus. And he takes the words of David on his lips and says, my God, why have you forsaken me? As he bears our sins in his body on the tree. So much nuance here, but I just want us to see that. That fundamental question of the sufferer is true of Jesus on some level when he is on the cross, suffering for you and for me. Crying out by day, crying out by night, no answer, no rest. Keep that language in your mind as we continue to read this psalm. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. Then verses 3 through 5. So in verses 1 and 2, there's looking around at the circumstances. Where is God? Why is this happening? But then immediately, verse 3 shifts gears. Verses 3 through 5, talking to God, praying to him. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. And you, our fathers, trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. And you, to you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. One of the most important things we can do when it feels like God is not here in our suffering is to look back and say, I'm not the only person to ever go through hard things. And God has been with his people in the past. And God has delivered them even when they could not see in the moment where God was or what was happening. They trusted in God and God came through. God turned their laments into praise. God rescued them in one way or another. And because God took care of them, God can take care of me. That is so simple, but it's so important for us to make that jump. And that's what faith does. It looks and says, if God can do that, then God can do this. And this is like why we have chapters like Hebrews 11, right? By faith, look at what God did for all these people. And Abraham, when God told him to sacrifice Isaac, I don't suspect if you asked Abraham in that moment, why is God asking you to do this? Abraham probably said, I have no idea. That is my question right now. But I know the God that I've trusted in, and I've seen him deliver me before. And I do not know why on earth my son is on this altar right now. But I'm going to raise the knife in obedience and trust. And God says, okay, I know that you trust me. And we can look back and see exactly what God is doing with that. And he was foreshadowing exactly what God himself would do with his son. So we've got to trust, even when we don't understand, even when we don't have an answer to the why question. That's what examples like Hebrews 11 give us. And so he looks back around at his circumstances, verses 6 through 8. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. There are some kinds of suffering that make us feel less than human. I am a worm and not a man. There are kinds of suffering and grief that strip away some of the basic human dignity that we want to feel. And that's what David is going through in this psalm. And that's certainly what Jesus was going through when he was being crucified. The shame of what he went through. And to add insult to injury, faith in God is specifically belittled. In verses 1 and 2, the psalmist is already struggling. God, where is God? And then on top of that, the people around him are looking at his faith in God and saying, ha! You trust in God? Well, let God come and rescue you if you trust in him. If you delight in him, come on down. Let's see your God come down. It reminds us of the showdown on Mount Carmel, doesn't it? And you have the prophets of Baal making their sacrifices, and Elijah is kind of taunting them, right? Hey, where's your God? Is he on a journey? You know, is he asleep? Is he using the bathroom? Like, where's your God? And we look at that from that end and say, ha, 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 ha. It's kind of turned on its head here. And it's the one who's trusting in Yahweh, trusting in Jehovah, who's now being mocked for their trust in God. And how hard that would have been, because as David felt that, he might have said, I have the same question. But I'm still going to trust God, even though I don't know exactly where he is right now, and you're mocking me for trusting in him. I will not let go. I will not let go of my trust in this God, because he's been true in the past. And I know that he will be vindicated. I will be vindicated if I just hold on. It's hard when the world around us mocks us and ridicules us. And we can expect more of that. We should expect more of that. But the Psalms show us how to weather and to endure when we are belittled and mocked for our faith in God. We will not be ashamed if we do not give up. Verses 9 and 10, he looks at his own past here. Verses 9 and 10, yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you I was cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. It's important for us, like the psalmist did in verses 3 through 5, to look at God's faithfulness to others. Our fathers trusted in you, and they were delivered. It's also important for us to look back at our own life, because there's not a one of us who cannot look back on some level in our life and see God's faithfulness to us in our own story. And that helps us to remember that if God came through for me then God will come through for me now. And how quickly we forget that we get in the same situation and God has delivered us before and then we doubt. It reminds me of the feeding of the 5,000 and then the feeding of the 4,000 and then in Mark's gospel, the feeding of the 12 in the boat. Do you guys remember that? Where Jesus tells the disciples, hey, you give them something to eat. And they're like, we don't have any kind of money to buy food for all this and there's no food out here. And then he takes care of them. And then a little while later, there's 4,000, and what happens? The exact same thing. And the disciples are like, where are we going to get food? And Jesus has to be like, guys, like, we've done this before. And then a little bit later, there's just 12 of them in the boat, and Jesus says, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod. And they're like, oh, no, we forgot to bring bread. And then Jesus kind of has a moment with them. He's like, okay, guys, listen. You remember the baskets for the 5,000 and 4,000? We do the same thing. We forget. And sometimes, if you're struggling with God's faithfulness, it's helpful just to sit down and make a list and to say, how has God blessed me in the past? What has God done to answer my prayers already? Prayer journaling, by the way, if you don't do that, is a really helpful practice. If you write out your prayers to God, one of the great blessings of that is to be able to look back and see how God has answered your prayers. Not always in the timing that we expected, not always in the way that we expected, but God answers. And that's what the psalmist does here. And he reminds himself of a time when he was totally dependent. He was a little baby. And God took care of him even then. On you I was cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb, you have been my God. I do think we see some hyperbole here in the Psalms. It's helpful, I think, to compare these verses to verses like Psalm 51, where David says, you know, in sin my mother conceived me, you know, I was brought forth in iniquity. I think both of those statements are hyperbole. Again, David is writing Psalm 22. David is writing Psalm 51. Well, which one is it, David? Were you sinful from your mother's womb, or were you trusting God from your mother's womb? They're both hyperbole. Little babies don't have a lot of either trust or doubt. They're just hungry all the time. It's helpful to remember as we read the Psalms that we're reading poetry, and there's going to be times where there's hyperbole. In just a minute, we're going to see a bunch of ravening animals coming at David. I don't think he was literally having animals come after him. I think they were people. And again, Jesus, in the same way, it wasn't animals who surrounded the cross. It was people acting like animals. And so as you read the Psalms, you can see that there's figures of speech, or even in Psalm 51, when David says, against you, you only have I sinned. Well, that's not literally true. David sinned against a lot of people, even in the Bathsheba incident. But there's an emphasis there, hyperbole, an exaggeration to make a point. So just helpful to note that as we read through the Psalms. Let's read verses 11 through 13. Again, switching back to looking around. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Many bulls encompass me. Strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouths at me like a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out. Oh, excuse me. You just get going in these Psalms and you want to keep reading. This suffering, it feels like there is no escape from this suffering, being completely surrounded. Where is God? I don't know where God is, but if I look in any other direction, I see enemies. And they've surrounded me like what? Like ravenous beasts. He's going to say this again in verse 16, for dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircles me. One of the challenging things about fighting with an animal is you can't plead for mercy, you know? Like, if it's an animal, like a dog or a bull or something coming after you, it's like they're hungry or angry or whatever, and like you can't talk to them. You can't say, hey, listen, I've got a family here, or hey, like, think about something else, you know, like try to appeal to them in some way. And that's the way David feels with his enemies, and that's the way Jesus feels. Is that these people are not acting like people. There's no reason, there's no sense, there's no escaping this. They're just coming at me like an animal. And they're going to rip me apart, and there's nothing I can do or say to change that. That's a helpless feeling. If you've ever felt that way, you can find that reflected here in these verses. It continues in verses 14 through 18. Again, poetry being used here to describe. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. For dogs encompass me. A company of evildoers encircles me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. I do believe that David, in writing these words, was speaking figuratively of something that happened in his life. But at the same time, we cannot miss that when you take this language and you look at a Roman crucifixion, you come away saying, this is prophetic. These words, how could this have been written 1,000 years before Roman crucifixion was even invented? How could this have been taken up? And then you look at Jesus on the cross, and again, not just Jesus himself, but they cast lots for my garments. The enemies of Jesus, who have no idea about Hebrew prophecy, are doing this. And even the Jewish leaders earlier were the ones saying, oh, he trusts in God. Let God come down and rescue him from the cross if he's the Son of God. I mean, man, not just Jesus, but the whole scene is seen so clearly 1,000 years before Jesus ever comes along. If you've ever done this with somebody, I think it's powerful. There's a couple passages to read if someone's needing some reinforcement about the Bible, is just to like open up Isaiah 53 and just read it with them and say, who is this talking about? And just let them make the connections. It doesn't take much. So people don't have to know a lot about the Bible to recognize, wait a minute. And then to say, when do you think this was written? This was written 700 years before Jesus was ever around. Psalm 22 is another one to take and read with people and to say, what do you see here? You see crucifixion here. When was this written? This was written 1,000 years before Jesus ever walked the earth. Powerful, powerful thing. Again, the Psalms are multifaceted as we study them. They're helpful for information. They're helpful for prophecy. They're helpful for evidences. And they're helpful for our own struggles and suffering. There's just so much value in these pictures. But as David looks at his situation, as Jesus literally has his hands and his feet pierced, as he can see his bones, as he's hanging there on a cross, we see in Jesus the picture of innocent suffering. There's no strength, no health, no dignity left in him. And yet he cries out to God. He will not let go. Verses 19 through 21. But you, O Lord, do not be far off. O you, my help, come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the mouth of the lion. And this last line of verse 21 is really interesting. You have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. In this last outcrying of trust, saying, God, please rescue me, please be with me, which, by the way, it's trusting in God, but the pain hasn't stopped yet. And still he's crying out to God and saying, God, I know you're going to take care of me. But I really like the very last line of verse 21. You have rescued me. It is a good rendering of the Hebrew there. And I like the New King James here. It actually puts it in like a separate little line here. The New King James reads, save me from the lion's mouth and from the horns of the wild oxen. And then it just puts it by itself. You have answered me. This is the first time in the psalm that something seems to shift. Something seems to change. And now from that phrase on, everything in this psalm is going to be praise. The psalmist did not think that God was going to come through for him. He didn't know where God was. He was pleading with God, asking for God, and he gets an answer from God right here. And I don't know what this would have been for David, and I don't know if we try to take this and read it through the eyes of Jesus, if this is when he says it is finished, and he yields up his spirit, and he's comforted, or if it's 3 days later on the first day of the week, when God answers him not only by delivering him through death, but delivering him from death, and he comes out of the tomb. Either way, God answered David, and God answered Jesus. And God will answer us if you will trust him and not give up. So the last part of the psalm, praise for deliverance. Let's just read this whole section. We'll point out a couple of things about it. Verse 22, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you offspring of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him, all you offspring of Israel. For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. And he has not hidden his face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. From you comes my praise in the great congregation. My vows I will perform before those who fear him. The afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nation shall worship before you, for kingship belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth shall eat and worship. Before him shall bow all who go down to the dust, even the one who could not keep himself alive. Posterity shall serve him. It shall be told of the Lord to the coming generation. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. This is the same psalm. Does it even sound like Psalm 22 anymore? I mean, we read the first part so much. This is the same psalm. And when Jesus, I believe, is quoting that psalm, he's taking the lament on his lips, but I believe we should have the whole thing in mind. When we're suffering and we're asking the why question, there is an answer coming. We may not fully understand it, but this psalm ends in beautiful praise. And it begins by talking about proclaiming what God has done for us to our brethren. And let me just say, this is such a cool connection and why we need to read the Old Testament carefully. Go over and read with me Hebrews chapter 2 for just a second. Hebrews chapter 2. In the first couple of chapters of Hebrews, the question is being raised, why did Jesus become a human? Why did he become a little lower than the angels? And Psalm 8 is another important psalm in this context. But I want you to notice one of the big answers to that question. Why did Jesus have to become human and suffer like he did? And so Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. Hebrews 2:10. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. Did you catch that? Jesus came here to suffer, and that perfected his role that God had for him. Verse 11, for he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, and guess where he's quoting from? I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. Of all the places that the Hebrew author could have quoted from, where does he quote from? To illustrate the point that Jesus has become our brother, he quotes from the psalm that talks in the most detail about the suffering of the Messiah. And because of what he suffered, he can look at you and he can look at me and say, that's my sibling. That's my brother. That's my sister. I've walked in your shoes. I've suffered like you've suffered. I've asked the questions you've asked. And now we're brethren. I who sanctify and you who are sanctified, we all have one Father. I learned to trust while I was suffering, so you can learn to trust while you are suffering. Jesus is not indifferent to our pain. He went through our pain. And so he can say without shame, I'll tell of your name to my brothers. Thank God that he came here and took those words on his lips. My God, why have you forsaken me? Because we can take great comfort in that. Now, when we suffer and we have the same questions, we can look at Jesus and Jesus can, so to speak, look us in the eye and say, I understand because I am your brother in suffering. And I'm here for you. Don't give up. Don't let go. Endure to the end. Such a powerful point. And again, it's easy to miss that if we're just reading Hebrews and we don't recognize where that quote's coming from in the context of Psalm 22. So study these Psalms. It makes the New Testament just come off the page. In verse 24, did you notice the shift from verse 2 of this Psalm where he said, I cry by day, but you do not answer. I cry by night. I find no rest. And then he says in verse 24, he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. I thought he had, but he didn't. He answered when I cried to him. God is there when we seek him. In verse 25, he says, because you've been faithful to me, I will be faithful to you. My vows I will perform. We talked about that. That's a very common element of the Psalms of Lament, is saying, God, I'm going to serve you. I'm going to return thanks for you and diligently give you my life because of what you have done for me. May we not miss that in this psalm. God delivers us not just to be comfortable, but to serve and fear and proclaim his name to other people and tell them what he has done for our soul. And that's how the psalm ends. All the nations are going to hear about this. Not just Israel, but everyone. I'm going to proclaim God's name to all the ends of the earth, and they're going to come and worship before God. He is going to rule all of the nations. And even the one who couldn't keep himself alive in verse 29. All different kinds of people are talked about here. And that the coming generation is going to remember what happened. And by the way, in a very literal sense, when does this happen? That all the nations of the earth stop and remember what God did every first day of the week? That's literally what happens, is we all stop and we remember what God did. He has done it. And we come together and we take the bread and we drink the cup and we remember the suffering of Jesus, our brother. And rejoice in that and proclaim that. And I love the very end of this psalm, verse 31. He's going to proclaim it to a people yet unborn. David didn't probably know how true that would be, right? I mean, none of us had been born at that point. And here we are 2,000 years later. Well, for David, 3,000 years later, right? On the other side of the world, proclaiming that God has done it. Through Jesus, God has done it. I hope this is helpful as we just walk through Psalm 22 and see how valuable this is for us when we suffer, as we look to evidences. But I don't want us to miss this, that if you just keep reading, after saying, "They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Because of Psalm 22, we can appreciate Psalm 23. And again, I don't know all of the reasons for putting these next to each other, but when you notice how connected they are. And do you see some of the connections that we talk about in these two Psalms? Yahweh is pictured as a shepherd in verses 1 through 3. This is, of course, going to be fulfilled in Jesus, the good shepherd. But there's comfort and confidence in the face of death. And we just talked about Jesus being our brother because he suffered. And now I can take comfort in God's staff and his rod as he leads me through the valley of the shadow of death, because he went through the valley of the shadow of death for me. In Psalm 22, he said specifically in verse 15, "You lay me in the dust of death." And now I can walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And you notice here that the enemies are still surrounding. Psalm 23 is a psalm of trust, which does not ignore the problems in our life, but it puts trust in God in the midst of our problems. It says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." They're still there, but God is providing for me in the midst of my enemies. That's exactly what happened. Even though the enemies were surrounding the psalmist in Psalm 22, hurling abuse and scorn at him, he trusted in God, and God did deliver him. He was not ashamed when he cried out to Yahweh. And so we trust that even in the midst of our enemies, he will prepare a table before us. He anoints with oil, which is really cool. This is the image of the Messiah, right? Of the Christ, of the one who is to come. And truly, we can say, "My cup overflows." I think it's fascinating to think about what Jesus said in the garden, "Father, let this cup pass from me." The cup of anguish, the cup of God's wrath that he had to drink, so that our cup could overflow. A cup of blessing, a cup of gratitude. There's several other psalms that mention this idea of the cup, the other side of the cup, of offering up a cup to the Lord, a thanksgiving, of praise. And ultimately, Jesus did all of this so that we could be with him forever. That's where David wanted to be, was in the house of the Lord for the rest of his days and on into eternity. And what Jesus did, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross and despised the shame. And what was the joy set before him? Jesus said, "I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be, in my Father's house." And that's where we want to dwell forever, because of what Jesus suffered. And if we will trust him, even when we don't understand, even in the midst of the enemies and the dogs and all that's going on, if we will trust him, we can dwell with him forever. Thank God for these treasures that he's given us in the Psalms. I hope that these can help you on the hard days. I hope that they'll help you even on the easier days to appreciate what Jesus has done for you.